You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Taking Down the Dragon. The many things wrong with the movie Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. I was aware of Bruce Lee before I was a martial artist. I first saw him as Kato on The Green Hornet when I was a 9-year-old boy in 1966 and was immediately smitten. Kato was my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Power Rangers. Unlike the Power Rangers and the Ninja Turtles, the popularity of The Green Hornet was short-lived, and the show was canceled after a year in 1967. I later saw Mr. Lee again, after I had begun training in karate, on the pilot for the TV series Longstreet in 1971. The episode was entitled The Way of the Intercepting Fist. By that time, I was already a fan of the TV series Kung Fu. The way Bruce Lee moved, however, made David Carradine in his role as Kwai Chang Kane look like a drunken ox by comparison. Later, I was to find out that the idea for the TV series Kung Fu was Bruce Lee's, of course with him playing the role of the Shaolin monk wandering through the Old West. Can you imagine what that would have been like? I think it would have had as large a fan base as Star Trek, and we would still be watching old episodes 45 years later. Instead, the producers to whom he pitched the idea rejected it, saying that they didn't think the American viewership was ready for an Asian in a leading role. They then stole the idea and cast David Carradine in the lead role. I wonder what those producers thought when they saw Bruce Lee's breakout success in films a few years later. Boy, were their lily-white faces red. When I saw Mr. Lee in the Longstreet pilot episode, I was immediately drawn to the martial philosophy he expressed during this television pilot. As time went on, I came to realize that the martial art which he taught to the lead character on this television show was his own creation. He called it Jeet Kune Do, the Way of the Intercepting Fist. I became obsessed with Bruce Lee and Jeet Kune Do as only a teenage fanboy can. I obviously admired his technical skill, but I also admired his philosophy. I was drawn to the way he explained things without resorting to magic or cryptic Asian philosophy. Just as Harry Houdini was a great showman who debunked spiritualists and served as a guiding light for the skeptical movement, so Bruce Lee was also a great showman who cut through a lot of magical thinking and other quirky and bizarre aspects of the martial arts. He was a pioneer of the modern martial arts. At his academy, he was doing what was essentially an early form of MMA more than a quarter of a century before the first Ultimate Fighting Championship. In a very real sense, he was the real founder of this podcast, not me. Once his film career began, I followed it avidly and was horrified when I walked in the door of my home one day at the age of 15 to hear my mother tell me, "Oh, by the way, that karate guy you really like died." Needless to say, I was crushed. A few years later, I bought my copy of the book that was pieced together from his notes, The Tao of Jeet Kune Do. As I have matured as a person and as a martial artist, my adolescent hero worship changed into a realization that Bruce Lee was only human, with a fallible human brain, a fact which in many ways added to my admiration. For one fallible human to have had such an effect on the martial arts across the entire planet this quickly was unprecedented. His life story was truly remarkable. All of which makes the movie Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, a great disappointment. In the early 90s, when I heard that a biopic of Bruce Lee's life was in the offing, I was simultaneously excited and nervous. Upon watching the film, I discovered that unfortunately, I had had very good reason to be nervous. This movie was so much less than it could have been. It can't decide what it wants to be. Sometimes it's a fairly decent depiction of the love story between Bruce and his wife Linda. At other times, it's a poorly done chop-socky kung fu film portraying the real person, Bruce Lee, taking part in more than half a dozen outrageous fight scenes, often against a gang of opponents, that never actually happened. And one depiction of a fight that did occur, but that is altered so much from what actually happened that it might as well be another fantasy fight like the others. And yet, at other times, the film tries to be some sort of psychological horror movie in which the Bruce Lee character has daytime hallucinations that I can only describe as psychotic breaks, seeing and even fighting against an armor-clad martial arts demon. This demon character is depicted as a personification of some sort of curse that Bruce's father implies hangs over the male members of the family. This touches on something I dealt with in episode number 32 of The Marshall Brain, entitled The Way of the Intercepting Myth. This is the assertion by some that because both Bruce Lee and his son Brandon Lee died young, that some sort of supernatural agency was at work. Listen to that episode to hear what I have to say to those who, quote, don't believe in coincidences, unquote. This fantasy element of the story is yet another slap in the face of a man who had his feet proudly planted in the real world. Those are the things the film tries to do. More disappointing is what it did not try to do. It failed to come anywhere close to adequately portraying Mr. Lee's revolutionary martial arts philosophy. While there were a few scenes where it was referred to, the total amount of time dedicated to this subject makes up a tiny fraction of the film. Far, far less time than the fantasy element of the martial arts demon. The only students of Mr. Lee depicted in the film, with the exception of his wife Linda, are fictional characters. None of his real students, including his top student, Dan Inosanto, are depicted. The DVD version of this movie, which I watched as research for this podcast, begins with a short video essay by Linda Lee Cadwell, Bruce Lee's widow. The movie is supposedly based on her book, Bruce Lee, The Man Only I Knew. In her video essay, Ms. Cadwell states that she thinks Bruce would have loved this movie. It puzzles me why she could and would make such a claim. Let's look at some of the stranger scenes from the movie. The first fight scene takes place in Hong Kong and shows about a half dozen either British or Australian sailors forcing their way into what appears to be a high school dance. Punching out several of the young Chinese boys, and aggressively forcing several young teenage Chinese girls to dance with them. A teenage Bruce Lee shows up and saves the day by whipping all of the sailors simultaneously by himself. The choreography of this fight scene is chock full of silly acrobatics and kung fu tricks that bear no resemblance to the way Mr. Lee would have ever fought, much less at this time in his life. At one point, the Bruce Lee character turns his back on his opponent, inserts his arms in the sleeves of the man's jacket so that they are both wearing the jacket at the same time, then mugs a few dance moves before bending over at the waist to flip his opponent forward. I know of no one who has ever heard of this gang fight against sailors story. Early in the film, the silly demon theme is introduced. Bruce's father, as depicted in the film, warns him of a demon that took, he says, his older brother as a child, and that now awaits him. Now, mind you, I am not speaking of a figurative demon, as we mean when we say someone is battling his inner demons, but in the film it is depicted as a real, supernatural demon, giant-sized and wearing Asian armor. Throughout the rest of the film, the Bruce Lee character is afflicted by sudden, unsolicited hallucinations in the middle of the day, in which he is pursued by this creature. I know of no such history of psychotic breaks from Mr. Lee's life story. The next fight scene takes place after Bruce has moved to the United States. While employed washing dishes in a Chinese restaurant, his innocent flirting with one of the waitresses enrages one of the restaurant cooks. The cook attacks Bruce, and the brawl rapidly escalates into six Chinese cooks, all armed with large meat cleavers, simultaneously attacking Bruce Lee. Again, the scene is outrageously choreographed and depicted. And again, I know of no reference to this story anywhere in his life. At one point in the scene, the Bruce Lee character is actually standing balanced on an I-beam far above the ground while cleaver-wielding Chinese cooks approach him from either side. Don't you think we would have heard about this kind of fight had it ever actually occurred? To make things even more ridiculous, this fight, which has already crossed the line from simple battery on the part of the cooks to multiple counts of attempted murder, suddenly stops when the woman who owns the restaurant steps out into the alley, claps her hands, and commands everyone to get back to work. They all grumble like young boys that have been caught misbehaving and sheepishly return to their normal tasks. Well, you know, boys will be boys. The next fight scene takes place after Bruce has enrolled in classes at a university. He is accosted by a gang of young, buff, racist students at the university gymnasium. He dispatches them simultaneously in the same over-the-top, outrageous kung fu style I have already described. After defeating this gang of thugs, in some cases using techniques that could easily have crippled them, two of them pick themselves up and cheerfully approach Bruce outside in the parking lot, where they ask him to teach them the martial arts. I don't know about any of you other martial arts instructors out there, but I can't tell you how many times I myself have picked up students from my academy in the same way. Not long after this, Mr. Lee opens a commercial martial arts academy. In a following scene, he is tapping away at his typewriter in the academy, working on a homework assignment for his university philosophy class, when the glass of the front door of his academy shatters as the martial arts demon charges through, grasps Bruce, and hoists him over his head, before slamming him against the wall. The demon faces the supine Mr. Lee calmly, places his feet together, and pushes his right fist into his left palm in the Chinese martial arts salute before leaving. What? Mr. Lee's perspective then dissolves back to reality, leaving you with the impression that it was just another daytime hallucination. I don't know about you, but if I was the Bruce Lee character depicted at this point in the film, I would have sought counseling long ago. The next scene begins this film's version of Bruce Lee's famous fight with kung fu practitioner Wong Jack Man, although in the film his opponent is given a different name. Accounts vary as to what actually happened during this fight. What is known is that for one reason or another, Bruce Lee was challenged to a match by a representative of the traditional Chinese martial arts community. Some accounts, and this film, say the challenge was presented because Mr. Lee refused a demand from the traditional Chinese martial arts community to cease teaching non-Chinese. Other accounts say that the Chinese martial arts community found Mr. Lee's behavior to be arrogant, reflecting badly on the rest of them, and forcing them to issue a challenge. In any case, in the real world, the match took place in Bruce Lee's academy. But in the film, it takes place in some sort of amazingly constructed underground grotto, where Bruce Lee and his opponent clandestinely meet to do battle, while a council of elderly Chinese masters sit on an overhang over the fighting area, ostensibly officiating over the fight. This fight is yet another over-the-top, outrageously choreographed martial arts fight scene. The Bruce Lee character wins the fight when his opponent finally submits. As Mr. Lee stands and turns to confront the council of elders, his craven opponent picks himself up and sneaks up behind him, where he kicks Mr. Lee in the back, inflicting a paralyzing spinal injury. The details of the real version of this fight are a source of argument even to this day. The film version, though, is so overly fictionalized as to be ridiculous. In no one's account of this fight was Mr. Lee seriously injured. He did sustain a back injury at this period of his life under completely different circumstances. It happened when he was weight training, specifically when he was performing the Good Morning Exercise. But the injury was severe back sprain, not paralysis. Mr. Lee's doctor suggested he spend time in extended bed rest. There was never any question that he would walk again. He probably got up every day and walked to the bathroom. The melodramatic, tear-jerking scenes in this film in which Bruce bravely fights paralysis and courageously struggles his way back to the ability to walk and eventually to train are, again, totally false and way over the top. Especially ridiculous is the scene in which his wife bursts into tears as he courageously stands up from his wheelchair for the first time and staggers to her birth bed in order to hold his newborn son, Brandon, for the first time. One part that the movie does get right is that Mr. Lee tried to use his downtime from this injury to begin writing notes for a future book on his martial arts ideas. Then, however, staying in character, the movie gets it completely wrong again and presents a scene in which Bruce receives a copy of his finished book, The Tao of Jeet Kune Do, from the publisher. There's only one problem. Bruce Lee never completed his work. He never submitted a manuscript to a publisher, and of course, he never received a copy of it during his life. I can well remember being a high school senior in 1975, 2 years after Mr. Lee's death, anxiously awaiting my pre-ordered copy from the very first printing of the Tao of Jeet Kune Do, which did arrive in 1975. I still own this rare hardcover copy. I'll do a future podcast on how this book was really put together and some of the misconceptions surrounding it. The next ridiculous scene is a dramatization of Mr. Lee's appearance at the 1964 Long Beach International Karate Tournament put on by Ed Parker. What Mr. Lee actually did at this tournament was put on a demonstration. Nothing more. So far as history tells, there was not a significant amount of negative interaction between Mr. Lee and the audience. But in the film, of course, the audience drowns him out with boos and catcalls as he speaks to them on a microphone about his revolutionary martial arts ideas. He even accepts a challenge to fight from an audience member, only to find out that his opponent is the opponent from his underground grotto fight, out to get revenge. This is utterly ridiculous and never happened. But it is a great excuse for the filmmakers to insert yet one more ridiculous fight scene. During the fight, his evil opponent once again kicks him in the spine, and Bruce sags against the ropes of the ring. His crisis is evident. He may not be able to finish the fight. But somehow he summons up his will, screams his rage, and renews the attack on his opponent, finally defeating him with 2 seconds to spare before the 60 seconds he had claimed it would take him to defeat his opponent. Our friend, the Martial Demon, makes yet another appearance when Bruce Lee travels to Hong Kong to attend his father's funeral. At the funeral, he has yet another psychotic break in which he sees the demon and nearly loses control. And just in case that isn't ridiculous enough, in the next scene, Bruce is visiting his old kung fu instructor, Yip Man, who tells him that his visions of the demon are not dreams, that they are real, and that he must prepare himself to struggle with the demon. The next fight scene in the film takes place after the beginning of Bruce Lee's movie career. He is in Thailand filming his first feature, The Big Boss, and is on the set when a car pulls up and out jumps the younger brother of the man with whom he has already fought twice in the film. First in the Underground Grotto and then at the Long Beach Internationals. Apparently, this fellow cannot abide his brother's defeats, and for some reason has traveled all the way to rural Thailand to exact revenge on Bruce Lee. What follows is yet another tedious, outraging, and confusing fight scene that I am pretty sure never happened in Bruce Lee's life. Mr. Lee is shown shattering huge blocks of ice with his bare fist during the fight, and is nearly decapitated by a giant buzzsaw, right out of a 1910 melodrama film from Hollywood. Towards the end of the fight, the villain shoves Bruce's head down into a pool of water and keeps it there until Bruce's body finally goes limp. Oh my God! Bruce Lee has drowned! As his opponent begins to celebrate his victory, Bruce Lee's corpse suddenly comes to life. Are we now to be presented with zombie Bruce Lee? No, Mr. Lee was fooling all along. He just pretended to be drowned. He jumps up from the pool and finishes thrashing his opponent. The surreal silliness of this scene continues when the Bruce Lee character stalks over to the movie camera on the set. The director had been filming the entire fight. Mr. Lee rips the film from the camera, not willing to allow the director to capitalize on the drama in his life. Okay, now the producers of this film are just fucking with us. I wonder if I should teach feigning death as a combat tactic at my academy. The film wraps up with a brief description of Bruce Lee's death as Linda Lee speaks voiceover. Now, Bruce Lee was many things to many people. To most people, he was a movie action hero. To others, he was an arrogant upstart. But to some of us, more than a few of us, he was a martial arts revolutionary. Bruce Lee's martial arts journey was one of discovery of truth. He took a scientific approach to combat. He was especially fascinated by Western martial arts like boxing, wrestling, fencing, and savate. He admired the effectiveness of these martial sports, which were not hampered by centuries of mystical tradition and obscurantism. Each of his 5 movies progressively showed the direction that he wanted to take martial arts cinema, leaving behind the outrageous wire work and impossible physical feats, culminating in his masterwork, Enter the Dragon. While this film is still martial fantasy, in that no one human could wade through that many opponents, he does it using real martial arts techniques, often backing the camera way up to show you the entire scene of the fight, using fewer quick cuts to cover up the mistakes and athletic inadequacies of stuntmen. Consider his fight scene in the movie entitled Return of the Dragon here in the U.S. and Way of the Dragon in other markets, in which he squares off with a villain portrayed by Chuck Norris in the climactic fight scene of the film. Most of the time, the camera is pulled back, again, to show all the action. The athleticism of each of the two actors is there to be seen by all. No tricks, just choreography that is revolutionary for its time, executed by amazing martial athletes. In contrast, the choreography and execution of the fight scenes in the film Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, in my opinion, would not have been well received by Mr. Lee. The film's obsession with the supernatural demon would also, in my opinion, not have passed the smell test for Mr. Lee. Bruce Lee's martial arts career, especially his teaching and writing career, was a beacon for those of us trying to find a sensible path towards martial arts excellence. This film does a poor job of portraying Bruce Lee's philosophy. The few scenes that do deal with this subject are poorly done and are pushed into the background by the outrageousness of the fight scenes and the silly fantasy scenes. For what it's worth, I think Bruce Lee would have reacted to this movie with horror. Perhaps it may have even triggered a psychotic break and given him hallucinations about horrible demons who produce poor quality movies about him. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.